Last time we saw how to build the canonical phase space of a gauge theory, like Yang-Mills theory, and how the gauge symmetries are implemented in it in the forms of constraint equations on the canonical fields, the connection, the gauge connection on the surface, and the electric fields. Then we saw that these constraints form an algebra, which is a representation of the gauge algebra on the surface. And we saw that this is what allows us to access the physical degrees of freedom of the theory in the form of the reduced phase space. So today we'll do gravity, GR, and see how things are similar and different, and especially what is different in GR. Why it's not like any other gauge theory. So, questions on this before, on any of these points? So, the way we presented the symplectic structure of GR when we did, for example, the Waltz entropy was in terms, oops, doesn't really matter, was in term of this GAB minus of this presymplectic current, then the point is that this is not presented in the canonical form. It's not some PD delta Q. It's a more involved equation. The point is that so I can. It's a famous computation by York, Gibbons, and Hawking to put this in a canonical form. So the point is that to do so, one needs to rearrange these, and in particular to rearrange these once integrated on the Cauchy surface sigma. So let's see how this works. First, a quick remark. Since dg is identically zero, one can see that this is also zero. So the delta acting on g or the delta acting on the gamma present in here have the same, give the same thing. So this implies that, in fact, theta let me do it roughly. This is delta gamma g. And so theta can be written as minus 1/2 GBC delta gamma ABC minus GAB delta gamma CBC. Okay. Now, why I'm writing it in this form? Because this is already a bit more similar to what we're used to from a gauge theory, where we have the connection, which is conjugated to a tensor. So gamma is a connection, a bit like A, and G is a tensor. Now, this is still not fully satisfactory for various reasons, because gamma in this formula depends on G. It's not an independent quantity, so we need to split things even farther. But when we do, for example, a phase, so to do things farther, it's a bit of a computation, so I will not really go into it all that much. But here we get square root of G and a theta A. So, and the point is that this n is now contracted with these gammas, right? So this has these are contraction of n with delta gamma. Now n delta gamma has a flavor of delta of the divergent of the gradient of n. So we can write this as that well, let's say plus and minus depending on the details that I'm skipping, delta n. So this is just to give a rough idea of where the final formula will come on, will come from. Delta n, if you remember from Ruth course, is the extrinsic curvature. Like if I put the indices in the right way, this will be the extrinsic curvature of the surface. So we call Kij is defined as the projection of this type of derivative. So what is its interpretation? Its interpretation is how my Cauchy surface, sigma, so this is m, changes in embeds in the four-dimensional space. So this is the normal at two neighboring points, and this is the derivative, and this is the, so therefore this is the extrinsic curvature. Good. So with this and some and quite some algebra, one can get to the final result, which is that this is minus 1/2 integral over sigma square root of h kij minus k hij. Oh, I didn't say what hij is. I will do it in a second. Let me write it like this rather. Plus a total derivative of square root of h, k, plus a boundary term, which we will set to zero because we will consider Cauchy surfaces without without boundaries, where this beta a is nothing else than this delta n plus GAB delta n b. And so one can see that nb is equal to zero because it's delta of n square, and n square is one. So it's a tangent vector to the surface, and therefore this makes it. So here, sigma si is the normal, is the time-like normal to the corner in case there is one. But in what follows, I will set this to zero because I will take this to be the case. So what is H? H is the first fundamental form, is the intrinsic metric to, is the metric intrinsic to sigma induced by GAB, and K is the extrinsic curvature, the second fundamental form. So induced metric on sigma, and kappa k is the extrinsic curvature. A nice way to think about k is that it is 1/2 of the lead derivative of h in the normal direction. So we see that this is pretty much h dot, right? Morally speaking, this is the time derivative of h in the normal direction. This is in quotes, this is the precise expression. So this is, now we are in a situation which really resembles the other theories that we saw. We have a degree of freedom attached to the surface, and its time derivative as the canonical momentum. So this is P delta Q. Then there is a total variation that will not enter the symplectic structure because the symplectic structure will be delta of these. And then a corner term which we will be happy to ignore just. So omega, so from these, one sees that the off-shell canonical phase space is given by the following. We go from F to P sigma, or P canonical. I think we called it P canonical. And so this takes my GAB. And what spits out is HIJ, which is the induced metric from G and over sigma, and these what they call pi aj. So this is I don't have, this is just a standard, maybe what I can call it is GAB, it's like the induced metric on sigma, and pi is in fact the square root of h, kij minus khij. So you can think of this as the Legendre transform, where we have a q and the p is like a velocity, right? So this is what this equation is telling us. So this is saying qp equal, q at sigma in a way, and, or if you want, gamma at sigma and gamma dot at sigma. So this is how to read this equation. It's just more involved because GR is complicated. So this is our canonical phase space, equipped with the canonical symplectic structure given by, maybe, do we want to keep, minus 1/2 over here, sigma delta pi j wedge delta hij. One brief remark is that pi is not a, so hij is a 3D tensor, whereas pi is a 3D tensor density. What does it mean, the density? It means that it comes from something that has a square root of h in front. So if you take diffeomorphisms, it doesn't just transform as a tensor in the usual way. There is also an extra factor that accounts for h. So if x is a 3D diffeo, so parallel to, tangential to the surface, we know that Lx of pi ij is equal to, so Lx of hij is the 3D metric, is the usual formula, where I put a bar to mean the 3D, so the induced metric, right? So this is the induced connection. Covariant derivative, if you want. And Lx of pi is, as usual, xk dk pi ij minus 2 pi, now I need to write it correctly, I dk xj. And now I run out of space, but there is also plus. Since it's a density, there is also the divergence of x coming in times pi. Sorry, it got scrunched, but it's divergence of x times times pi aj itself. So this is because it's a density and not just a tensor. Okay. And if you, from here, just a simple thing, this is, so the trace of k is the interpretation of how the area element, the volume element changes in the n direction. So it's the lead derivative of square root of h. Okay. Good. So this is the, this phase space that we just constructed is called P can with omega can is the ADM phase space. And that term there, that corrective term in the symplectic potential that switches from the Einstein-Hilbert formula to the canonical formula for sigma, for, sorry, this delta exact correction that that let us go from the Einstein-Hilbert potential to the canonical potential is called the Gibbons-Hawking-York term. So we will not really use it. Ruth mentioned it in her class, but I will just, for me, it's just a step in this computation. So it has other applications, but I will not go into them. And the last term, you need to consider it only if you have corners, so most of the time it's just dropped. Okay. And ADM stands for Arnovitz, Deser, and Misner, who pioneered the canonical analysis of GR in these 3+1 variables. Okay, well, pioneer, they basically did everything that there was to do. So what is this canonical phase space? Is T star is a cotangent bundle of what one would call, could call, rim sigma. So is the Riemannian structure on sigma. So pi, if I forget that pi comes from a notion of extrinsic curvature, is just the momentum in the cotangent bundle of, is the momentum coordinate in cotangent bundle of the space of Riemannian structure on sigma, which is given by the possible matrix, Euclidean matrix on sigma. Good. Now we move on to the analysis of the constraints and the symmetries. Questions? Okay. Symmetries. So let me take a four-dimensional diffeo. So four-dimensional diffeo are vector spaces on M. And vector fields on M, and if I take such a vector field at sigma, which is where I'm working in a canonical formalism, I can decompose it into a tangential piece and the normal piece. So this is equal to, by definition, HAB of psi B. So it's the projection. This belongs to, this is in the tangent space of sigma. And this is the normal part. So this n is basically minus because of the signature n dot psi at sigma. So why I do this will be, well, first because it's quite natural. And then we will see that if we do this, we can rewrite the constraints associated to x and n in separate forms that depend on the canonical variables. Now, one remark. This decomposition requires knowledge of full of the entire GAB, by which I mean HAB and even HIJ and even K is not enough. So I know that here I'm writing HAB and this is HIJ, but the index structure is important. So this is the projection from the 4D space to the tangent space. To do so is not enough to know the induced metric. So the fact that here there is an index up is because it changes completely the meaning of the symbol. So it's a bit confusing, but this is a bit standard notation, and I don't know what to do about it. Yeah. So HAJ is the intrinsic metric, whereas this is the projection to the tangent space. And this requires knowledge of more than just the intrinsic metric. So this is already calling a little bit for trouble because we are taking our four-dimensional diffeo and splitting it, but the split cannot really be done within our canonical phase space. We will see later that this will be relevant too. This is a theme in a sense that will keep coming up. So now we take the Noether current, and you will remember that the pullback of the Noether current to sigma is given by some constraints times a total derivative dj of psi. Last time we focused pretty much on this when we did the walled entropy because this was giving us the Komar charges. But this time we will ignore corners and we are more interested in how do we go to the shell. So our focus will be the constraint piece. Constraints, and here ignore because this time we take no corners. So if I look at Q sigma of psi, which is defined as the integral of J over sigma, I'm left with these constraints. So what are these constraints? These constraints, if you remember, are just the DC was essentially the equations of motion. So here will be, since it's integrated over sigma, is the equations of motion contracted with the normal. So this will be, let me hope. So this is up to, again, as usual, up to signs. NAB, GAB, plus lambda, GAB, psi B. So maybe I call this B. Okay. Or if we want to keep the index structure more similar, we can do that. So the constraints are the components of the equations of motion projected along n. So these are my constraints. And the point is that one can check. As it should, that these do not depend on these guys. So facts. This constraint can be, maybe let me do one more step. So the what I want to do is to rewrite this as the split my x. So this becomes NA GAB. Now, there's no lambda if I put here x, because it's projected. This would be the contraction of n with x, with the tangential piece, which is identically 0, plus NA GAB. So NA and B, GAB plus lambda GAB N. So what I will call this is V of X plus H of N. So this is the vector constraint. This is called the vector constraint. And this is called the Hamiltonian constraint. The important thing is that these two can be written in terms of H and pi only. It's highly not obvious in here, because GAB a priori contains second time derivatives of H, but fact, although GAB contains second time derivative. By time, I mean in derivative in the normal direction, of course. Time derivatives of H, IJ, which are essentially first time derivative of K, which would not be part of the phase space, which are not phase space variables. The constraint can be fully written in terms of H and pi. So how do we do this? So Vx. So in practice, what we're saying is that V and X project nicely to the canonical phase space. So in bundle in mathematical language, they're basic with respect to that projection. But in any case, so this says that sigma is again, my signs are completely untrustworthy, so my apologies. Xj and Hn is equal to, and this is a bit of a computation, and I will just, which I'm not going to do. So this is d minus 1 if you are in d dimensions. So my dimension is in fact here. Well, let me do it in four dimensions. So minus 1/2 square root of h r minus 2 lambda. So it's a bit of a long formula. So why there is the square root of h at the denominator? Because pi were already densities. So here we have two densities. We need to remove one square root of h. So this makes sense. And here is upstairs, because this is the usual. This is the 3D Riemann tensor associated to hij. And that's what it gives. So how do I find these, I use the Gauss-Kodaty equations that allow to decompose the 4D Riemann into 3D Riemann's plus extrinsic curvature. I massage it for a few lines and I get out this. So it's okay. So two comments, remark. V, the vector constraint, looks like a Gauss constraint. And indeed, why? Because this is the divergence of our electric field, of our momentum. So it has the same structure as a Gauss constraint. And indeed, tangential vector fields behave very much like gauge transformations in this theory. Tangential diffuse behave very much like Young-Mills gauge transformations.
Over.
Yes.
Where is the dependence on M in H of N?
On?
On M.
In what?
In H of N, the Hamiltonian constraint.
Oh, it's all multi. Sorry, you're right. Yes, thanks. It's all multiplied. It's like here is the smear constraint. So this is what has to be zero because this must be zero for every possible n. It's like the Gauss constraint to get the divergence of E times the gauge parameter. These have the same structure. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, that was important. Okay, so this is the first expectation, and we will see that is indeed realized. And the second remark is that, these Hamiltonian constraints, and maybe I'm the Hamiltonian constraint can be written as follows. H, so I'm now calling, it's a bit of an abuse of notation, I'm calling H the integrand. So maybe I call it curly H. Can be written as 1/2, and here, for lack of a better notation, I write it like this, ijkl, pijpkl, minus u of h. So. So in this way, the Hamiltonian constraint looks a bit like a standard Hamiltonian, the square of the momenta times a potential, where the potential is this 1 over 2. I'm not fully sure why I'm reinstating the Planck square in here, but why not? The Planck area times the 3D Riemann and the cosmological constant. So this is the potential of this Hamiltonian, and the kinetic term is given by H I K H L J minus 1/2 H I J H K L. So this is called the DeWitt metric. DeWitt supermetric. Why supermetric? Because it is a metric in the space of 3D geometries. So this is a metric in Riemann of sigma. So here we are recasting GR as a dynamical theory over Riemann of sigma. So it's a dynamical theory on superspace. So as a particle is a theory of something moving in R3, and R3 is the target space of this, of the particle field, if you one-dimensional field. Here we have something similar. We have one configuration is a 3D metric, and this Hamiltonian helps us reconstruct its history over the space of 3D metrics. Sasha?
Can you just ask, is this in relation to area metric? I've seen that area metric formalism for
I don't know. I don't think so. This is super standard in. I don't know, but I would suspect no, because here the degrees of freedom are the 3D metric itself. It's not an extension, but I don't know if you write area metric gravity, then something like that. It's very similar shows up. I don't know. This factor of one half is crucial too. Is really what makes GR GR. A priori, one can define other supermetrics on this space just by tweaking this parameter. But in fact, only this one is compatible with four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. So it's really tight. Must be one half to get a 4D diffeo invariant theory at the end of the day. I say at the end of the day because so far we have not talked about how a four-dimensional manifold and a four-dimensional diffeomorphism symmetries is encoded in this data. In fact, it's quite subtle the way it works. But at the end of the day, this one half will be very important. So this H is not a usual Hamiltonian. It's a constraint. It's like when you did the parameterized particle, you ended up having a Hamiltonian constraint and not a real Hamiltonian in the usual sense. So like for the parameterized particle, H is no real Hamiltonian. But a constraint. And the way you reconstruct the dynamic out of it is very, conceptually, is very similar to the way you do for the parameterized particle. So, and here is just something super sketchy in a sense, but formally, physical states in quantum gravity must satisfy H psi equals zero. So where here we have, well, let me write it like this, H psi equals zero. So this is the wave function of the universe. And this is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Function of the universe. And this is called the Wheeler-DeWitt. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation takes the form of, let me put the two. So this takes the form 2H psi in the Schrödinger in like a polarization where I pick the metric here. It gets IJKL delta delta IHJ delta delta LK psi plus square root of h r3 psi equals 0. Well, this is with lambda equals 0. If there is lambda, it's just... So this is, and you will see that contrary to the parametrized particle, this depends quadratically on the momenta, and there is no momentum with respect to which this expression is linear. So it cannot be deparametrized. We cannot find one good notion of time to rewrite this Schrödinger equation in terms of a standard Schrödinger equation. H quadratic in P, in momenta, no natural, in fact there is none at all, no natural time, physical time if you want, physical time to deparametrize the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So this is contrary to what happens in the parametrized particle. So parametrized particle is nice for certain to understand certain conceptual issues, but it's quite a bad model to understand others. As expected. Okay. So here what we did was to study these constraints and look at them, write them down. The next step is we need to answer two questions now. Question one is how I'm just wondering which order I should answer them, but question one is how do the constraints relate to four-dimensional diffeos? In question two is does their algebra close? So what does it mean? Is the Poisson bracket of two constraints another constraint, proportional to a constraint? So why this is important? This is important because if they don't close, there's no way to implement them on phase space coherently and to define a reduced phase space. On the other hand, the question is, what is this reduced phase space about? Is it about the space of four-dimensional spacetimes modulo four diffeos? It is, but in a rather subtle way, and this is question one. So let me start from question one. I will start from question one, then do question two, and then go back to wrap up. So in F, we have the equation, well, let me even write it on sigma. So in Yang-Mills, this was it. So there was an obvious relation between the and Q was the Gauss constraint that was easily writable in terms of the electric field and the potential on sigma, and the gauge potential on sigma. So this equation already was telling us that everything would have gone down smoothly, and we could have implemented gauge transformations over the 3D surface canonically, and we could have defined the reduced phase space and so on. But here what we discover is that there are two obstructions, one we care about and one we don't care about that much. So one is the one given by the equations of motion, delta GAB. And then there is the corner one. The corner one, as usual, we will set it. Well, as usual for today, we will set it to 0. So this last time we focused on this in the world entropy was what was allowing us to correct the energy to get the right quantity. We were working on shell, so with this we didn't care about. Again, today we do the opposite. We care about the other term. So what is the problem in this equation? Can we write this equation, or can we project, in a sense, this equation down to P, to the canonical phase space? Can we write it in terms of the canonical variables? So remember, we are off shell, so the equations of motion are the equations of motion. We cannot get rid of them. So let's analyze these into steps. Step one, for tangential differs. If you want x, xi equal x. So in this case, I've written over there how these tangential differs act on h and pi. And those expressions are closed. So we can both write down the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And we get that, so rho x descends to p. As I wrote above, I'm not going to copy the formula. It's just in that corner. So it means that I can write its action on h and pi in a closed form. And this equation become rho x of omega canonical equal to minus delta v of x, because q on the tangential piece is the vector constraint. And then this one gives 0, because this term does not appear for tangential differs. So this is there only for normal differs or transverse ones. So here everything goes well. Everything goes well, like for Young Mills. So now what happens to the Hamiltonian, to the normal diffuse? So let's look at for a second at rho, let me call it rho n. It's a bit of a, it's just a rho, well, rho n of, like, let's look at the simplest possible case, a diffeomorphism in the normal direction with unit laps. So this big N, I put it to 1, just to study the simplest example. So what happens when I apply this rho n to hij? If I apply this rho n to hij, I do get k, right? Is what, so this is ln hij, and this is 2kij. So here, I can write this in terms of pi, no problem. OK? So it's a bit of a more complicated expression, because this is k and not pi, but I can invert the relationship and just write it. So this is pi over square root of h plus corrections. Now, what happens if I do this for k, for pi? For pi, I run into a pickle, because this guy, this will be like a, if you want k dot, well, this will be pi dot.
or H double dot.
And these are not quantities that are available in phase space, in canonical phase space. So I never have to represent the acceleration in a canonical phase space. In fact, I can't. So not not a variable on therefore rho of n does not descend to the so I can't even talk about four-dimensional diffuse over the canonical phase space. They don't make sense. And the counterpart of this is the second equation. So here we looked at rho descent, so we can write down the left-hand side of the flow equation. Now we look at the right-hand side. On the right-hand side, what do we have? Q becomes H. We are happy. The problem is that on the right-hand side, there are those equations of motion. The term I-N-E involves a second derivative of H. So if you want H dot dot. So this is the counterpart. Of course, if these derivatives appear on the left-hand side, they must appear on the right-hand side. And that's where they appear, in that obstruction term. So same problem. Conclusion, 4D diffuse can't be represented or don't act on so the basic symmetries of our theories are not encoded straightforwardly in our phase space. If you remember, this is very similar to what happened in the parameterized particle case. Well, just to some extent. We couldn't really implement this fake time reparametrizations over that phase space. We had this other constraint. We had a similar flavor, but it wasn't quite the same thing. So here is the same. This Hamiltonian constraint will help us recover all the symmetries of GR, but in a very turnaround way. So this is, now I go back to question one. I go ahead to address question two. So question two, this is the situation, but what about my four constraints. So do they close and what do they generate? Well, what is their meaning? So these constraints form an algebra. So they do close. And one has that two vector constraints. Now, again, don't trust my signs. But bottom line is that the vector constraints behave just as you would expect them to behave, like in Young-Mills. So this is the Lie bracket of the two vector fields. Now, how does the Hamiltonian constraints change under a space like diffeomorphism? This is also easy, because everything that enters the Hamiltonian constraint is pi and h's that we know how they transform. So this is the same as asking how does H transform under a space like diffeos, and this we know. So this is H of, so it transforms covariantly, and if it transforms covariantly, it means that it transforms by Lie derivative, this part in the square bracket. But if this is just, since it's a scalar, it's just a derivative, so we can move it to n by integration by parts. So it's just H integrated over xn. Maybe I should write it lxn. I don't know. It's kind of so this also closes nicely. This is all is good. So far we have 3D diffeos and a scalar on the surface, and everything transforms as expected. And the surprise is, of course, when we try to write down the bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints. So this gives, and this is a complicated calculation, H of, let me call it, well, I can also write it like this. So this is n h I, sorry, what am I saying? So this is not n, this is v. V of h I j dj m minus the opposite. So the idea is that by commuting two Hamiltonian constraints, we get a vector constraint. And this vector constraint needs to eat a vector, a space-like vector. But how do I build a space-like vector out of two scalars? Well, I need the metric to raise the index. So the fact that here there is the 3D metric is the most important thing in this whole formula. So this algebra of constraint is called Dirac's hypersurface deformation algebra. And I put algebra in quotes because it's not an algebra. It's not an algebra because it would be structure constants are field dependent, depend on H. Structure constants depend on HIJ. So this is a quite a new feature that we have never encountered before. So Dirac discovered this algebra so his idea was, okay, GR is very hard. We will not be able to solve it anytime soon. So why don't we study a little model? For it, little model, instead of the parameterized particle, he did the parameterized scalar field. Because what he was interested in understanding is how refoliation invariant, how you can talk about dynamics in a refoliation invariant manner. This is the exact analog of the parameterized particle for a scalar field theory. And he discovered that the refoliation invariance of the theory is encoded in this algebra, but over the scalar field phase space in his case. So V and H were whatever they were, but for the scalar field, not for the space-time metric. And in that case, the metric here was just the metric of space-time, which was fixed. He was even studying just a scalar field on Minkowski in with respect to an arbitrary foliation. So this was how it evolved, how things were evolving, for how H was evolving the scalar field in this arbitrary foliation situation, because n, if you look, h of n is kind of pushing your surface by an n amount in the normal direction, this by an m. And so it says, oh, what happens if you first push it by n, then by m, or vice versa? This is commuting the two evolutions. And it says, you get the same thing, but translated by a space-like diffeo. So he found it in that context. But the point is that one can show, and this is what Teitelbaum and Hodgman and Kukash did in the 70s, you can show that this hypersurface deformation algebra is would appear any time you are trying to implement this refoliation invariance of the dynamics. And in GR, in fact, you can say they proved that the only way to implement this algebra over the phase space T star of rim of sigma, so over a 3D matrix, is to have that exact functional dependence on P and H. You can't do anything else. And the reason why it is so rigid is because of this field dependence. So this field dependence can be leveraged to give a uniqueness theorem that from this formula here with mild technical hypotheses gives you GR in that form. So GR is the dynamics of GR is completely tied to its symmetries. That this is essentially the bottom line. And so you can't deal with one as I was saying last time, you can't deal with dynamics perturbatively and symmetries non-perturbatively, because the two things are essentially the same. Okay, so and one last thing. So how does this relate to 4D diffeos? This is not quite 4D diffeos. This is refoliation invariance, which is a related symmetry, but it's not quite the same symmetry. And the point is that until you go on shell, you solve for the dynamics, you are on shell of the constraints and so on, there is no four-dimensional space-time at all. You just have rim. You have just have four 3D metrics and a quantity that eventually you will be able to interpret as extrinsic curvature, but it's just this momentum, in fact. So off shell, you can't even talk about four-dimensional space-times in this setup. And it's only once you implement the constraints that you get a four-dimensional space-time. And that since it's a geometrical construction, that it will be four different variants. So it's quite a turnaround way in which four-dimensional diffeos are emerge in the canonical theory of gravity. But it's very complicated. But it's also, this looks a bit like a fluke. Can we fix it? Choose different variables? In fact, no. It's very structural because you can leverage these to reconstruct GR out of just this algebra, essentially. Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit more why it's bad that the structure constants depend on the field?
Because it makes, well, this is not even an algebra. It's very hard to quantize something like this. There are no techniques. In fact, it's, yeah, there's, the off-shell structure of this bracket is really, I don't know how to say it more precisely. It's very complicated, and so so already going in LQG variables simplifies things. It doesn't change the fact that this algebra is the same structure, but it makes H and, well, V is already simple enough, it will not change. But it makes gives H a much simpler form, so you can hope to do something with it. But in reality, it's still extremely hard to deal with that. So there are, in a way, formally it has been quantized. There are theorems that say, oh, something exists and so on. But concretely, doing computation with it is a completely abstract quantization. That so in a way, LQG succeeded. But at such an abstract level that you can't use it to compute things. It's too up there in a sense. So having a And in a way, it's not a quantization, a direct quantization, as you would do it for another field theory. Is that there are some discrepancies, like some subtleties in the way the quantization is built. But it's just, yeah. I don't know how to give give more. Okay. Yeah.
Like, given a field configuration, the algebra does close, right?
Given a field configuration, this is not so much. Given a field configuration, this algebra does not make sense because this is the algebra that moves you around phase space with respect to your symmetries, in a sense. It's applying. This algebra, it doesn't make sense at one configuration. Unless you're looking at the scalar field on a fixed spacetime. In that case, sure, it's one configuration of the metric, and you're looking at how the scalar field moves around in that background. But for gravity, the two things are completely tied to each other. So this is telling you how your configuration changes upon refoliation.
So you want an algebra that like exists independently and then has an action on the phase space.
Yeah.
Since the structure of the algebra you need depends on where you are in the phase space.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes.
So does that mean that a theory of quantum gravity has to be non-perturbative?
Every theory is non-perturbative because it is what it is. It's just that we compute things perturbatively needs and
computation. And when you do computations,
it kind of does. I don't think we can do things fully non-perturbatively. So maybe the question is how can we get around this problem? And I don't know the answer. How one can find schemes where you are not, one is not destroying too much of the symmetries, and one can still compute stuff. But here I'm trying to convey the idea that is quite delicate to do it directly. So in a theory where one is not trying to quantize, where gravity emerges from other things, maybe there are other ways to get around that problem. But if you try to quantize it head on, you face these complications. Thanks for attending the course, and see you in tutorial tomorrow. And
thank you.